I'm going to hand over first of all to the keynote for this track with Rue on the whole notion of 3D worlds.
Thanks very much. So, yes, I am Rue Reynolds, and these are my cards. My IBM business card actually has the title on it, Metaverse Evangelist, which I'm very proud of. My colleague Ian Hughes started calling himself a Metaverse Evangelist at the beginning of last year. And we do the same thing, we work in the same office, and so I decided I was going to copy him. So I just changed my employee profile, and now I'm a Metaverse Evangelist too. The word Metaverse is one of those science fiction terms, and maybe it's worth, in order to explain what I do, maybe it's worth starting there, starting with that word Metaverse. Neal Stephenson wrote this book in 1992, I think, called Snow Crash. And in it, he envisions a world which contains a digital universe going on inside it, in which you can live an alternate life. So you might be a pizza delivery person in the real world, but inside the metaverse, you might be a samurai sword-wielding fighter. And you can see a quote here from the book where he first talks about the metaverse. And he introduces this idea of an avatar, a character that represents you, that is you inside this virtual world, this digital online environment where multiple people can see each other and talk to each other at the same time. It might look like a game, but it's not a game. It's a social space. It's somewhere that you can just go and be and live out your life. And in fact, this quote ends with a very nice sentence about how he sees these other couples walking around in the street, but he doesn't talk to them, because he wouldn't talk to them in the real world. And some of the social etiquette, and I mean, it's a fascinating book. If you're interested in this stuff at all, I'd really recommend the book to you. But of course, as with terms like cyberspace, this science fiction term has come to become real, it's been rarefied. And things like Second Life are great examples of a virtual world, a metaverse, if you like, a digital universe within this one. Has anyone heard of Second Life in the last couple of years? Nearly everyone. Can I ask the very rude opposite question? Is anyone completely oblivious to what Second Life is in the room? Okay, nobody. I think nobody. That's a big change. A year ago, 2 years ago, the opposite was true. People hadn't really heard of this. Where they were beginning to hear it in the press, they hadn't tried it for themselves. So let me ask the obvious follow-up question. If you've heard of Second Life, if you actually logged in, has anyone here tried it? Has anyone walked around as an avatar? Okay, a much smaller number, probably maybe a third of you have actually tried it for yourselves. And that's what I've come to expect in the last couple of months. I should point out Second Life is not the only virtual world. There are lots of others. This one's called there.com. It's very similar in many respects, slightly different in the way you get content into it. There are lots of others as well. I mean, there are a huge number of these different spaces. And some of them are aimed at different people. So Habbo Hotel is aimed at kind of a pre-teenage market. The Sony Home, Sony PlayStation Home in the bottom right over there, that's in beta at the moment on the Sony PlayStation 3. So if you own a PS3, you can walk around inside this beautifully rendered 3D world, and you can meet people, you can meet friends, and then you can play games with them. All of this brings to mind two different important things that are going on the web at the moment. The first one is social networking. Really, this idea of networking is not new, but it's something that online has become a very big phenomenon. It's become a big way of people spending their time online, which maybe a few years ago, maybe they weren't doing that. Maybe they were doing other things with their time online. The other thing that's going on the web at the moment is user-generated content. People making their own stuff and sharing it with other people. We no longer think of the web as somewhere we go to consume professionally oriented and professionally generated content. We go there to share our own videos, and we go there to share our own thoughts of the world and what's going on. And that has been a big shift. And I mean, we've talked a lot in the last few days, and I've been sat mainly in this auditorium listening to this track about social networking, user-generated content, and Facebook and other things like it. And it should be quite obvious that is where the web is already. You know, Web 2 is not something that's new and a long way away. This is something that we're already very heavily dealing with. But I find it quite interesting that these worlds, these virtual worlds like Second Life and there.com and some of the others that I showed you, actually exhibit those same tendencies. People go there to make friends and to meet friends and to build relationships. And they go there to share their own content. They go there to build things and to have other people use those things. Or even just to admire them and be impressed by them. And that could be a pair of trainers that somebody makes and sells to somebody, or it could be a beautiful house or a beautiful structure. And it sounds frivolous, but people want to create and they want to share with other people the things that they're making. So I've talked a lot there about virtual worlds and as a kind of platform that you can just do things in. Let's start with a virtual world that's really a game, and this is the only game that I'm going to talk about today, and it's World of Warcraft. Warcraft is a very big, very popular, massively multiplayer online role-playing game. And it's been described recently by Corian Drecker, who's actually the CTO of Linden Lab. He described it as the new golf. Now, I think that's an interesting analogy. Golf is a game. It's a game that has etiquette. It has conventions. You have to wear strange clothes. You have to go to a certain place to play it. It's got certain rules. I'm not a golfer, by the way. I'm not going to be very rude. Anyone play golf in the room? Anyone play Warcraft in the room? About the same, okay. So I don't play golf, but I watch people who do with a growing sense of interest the more I think about what people do with their time and how they're socializing and how they're building relationships. Because that's what they're doing when they're playing golf. They're not just getting better at hitting a little ball around a field and trying to land it in 18 different very small holes. They're talking with people. They're building relationships. They're making business deals. And for a long time, this has been, especially in this country, but in a lot of the West, this has been where you go to broker relationships, where you go to build friendships with other people, people you're trying to influence. Now, golf has been that for us in the physical realm for a long time. And Corian Drecker is suggesting that maybe Warcraft and other things like it are the equivalent for the next generation. And not just, I don't believe this is just a generational thing. I think there are early adopters of all ages. And I think digital natives, people who spend a long time online, of course they're going to build relationships online. Of course they're going to influence people and make friends and find new places to work and find new people to work with and new projects to work on. Of course that's how they're going to spend their time, because that's what we do. We're social creatures as humans. And it doesn't matter whether we do it face-to-face or whether we do it online. We're going to have the same kind of conversations. This is a sort of typical screenshot of what Warcraft might look like if you were to actually play it. This is what Warcraft looks like if you've modified your user interface quite a lot. Joy Ito, who's a venture capitalist, very nice guy, he has a very big and successful guild, a kind of collective of people who work together, and they play together, and they play Warcraft. And when he plays Warcraft, it looks like this. He's changed it completely. He's added all of this extra content. He's got things in here, in addition to the normal things like the chat and the spells that you can cast. He's got a huge amount of information about people he's playing with, what they're doing. He's directing 20 or 30 people at a time, and they're all working together. Now, what he's doing here is not so much playing a game. In fact, you can barely see the game behind all of this text. He's controlling a dashboard. He's running a very complex operation, and it's almost incidental that it happens to be a 3D game going on there. It's an enormous amount of data that he's having to parse and deal with and interpret. So IBM's been thinking about this for a while. We published a paper in 2005 called The Global Innovation Outlook. That was actually the second iteration. There's a third one coming soon. And in it, we talked about MMOs, about massively multiplayer online games, and how we can learn from them. And the business world can learn from this this kind of thing, this amazing amount of data that people are parsing, the idea of leadership and people exhibiting traits of leadership, even though it's inside a game, because they're helping people, they're helping dozens of people towards a common goal, and they have to have the charisma and all of the leadership attributes that go with being a successful leader. And maybe if we can spot people while they're playing games at the age of 15, 16, maybe they will become the new business leaders. Maybe the MBA should be completely revolutionized. And some people are already experimenting with this. I know L'Oreal for a long time have had run a virtual company game. It's a game, but it's a business training exercise. And people do well enough to get an internship at their actual real-world company. So where do you work? Do you work somewhere like this? Do you work somewhere with closed doors and nobody talking to each other, little silos where you're really having to struggle to talk to each other? Well, I'm pleased to say that I don't work somewhere like this. This is not a photo of my own. I work in IBM Hursley, which is a software lab in South England. And I don't have a photo of it, but it doesn't. Well, not much of it looks like this, anyway. I found this on Flickr, and it was entitled A Workplace With No Cheer. And it rang a bell with me. It made me think of some of my friends and colleagues and some of the people that I have bumped into in conferences like this one. And the way that they talk about work, and I was pleased to see some heads shaking when I said, is this where you work? And I saw some others nodding. People have to talk to each other. And we've heard a couple of times speakers on the stage in the last 2 days challenging people and saying, are you banning, oh, I thought I wouldn't mention Facebook again. Are you banning Facebook inside your corporation? Are you blocking people from getting outside and socializing externally? Because you need to trust them. And if you trust your employees, and if you allow them to build relationships within the company, but also outside the company, then they're going to do a better job for you. They're going to know each other better, and they're going to know the world better, and they're going to be more relevant, and they're going to have a wider radar of information that they can draw on when they're making decisions. So inside, this is a very simplified model, but inside any company, you'll find that people interact very frequently with the people around them. And they'll do some of that face-to-face if they can physically do that. If they physically work together with people, of course they'll go for the easiest option. Now, I'm assuming that in some cases, you will have relationships with a close team, people very close to you, who you can't see physically every day. And this happens to me a lot. I work in a very distributed team, and a lot of our conversation is still done through email. Then there are people who work slightly further away. And I don't just mean physically, I mean politically. They work in another department, they work in another division, but they also work in other companies. And these people you'll speak to less frequently, but you still have to maintain a relationship with them. You still have to know what they're doing. They have to know what you're doing. You might be sending the occasional instant message or emailing each other less frequently. But what about all these other people? These people that you don't even know exist. In my company, there are 330,000 people spread around the world. Not everybody works in companies quite as big as that one. But I'm sure that you can think of situations where you've had a need to communicate with somebody that you didn't even know existed. And this is where social networking comes in. Because if you can learn from other people, and if they can learn from you, and you can do that in a much wider scale than you could ever manage with email. I mean, there's no way I'm going to maintain an email relationship with more than, well, as few people as possible, to be honest with you. I'm bored sick of email. But there's no way I'm going to be able to maintain a good relationship with such a point-to-point mechanism. I need something broadcast. I need something where I can come back to it later. And if somebody joins a department, why should they have to trawl through 500 copies of emails, that have been going back for the last 5 years to catch up? That's crazy. This stuff should be being documented as it happens. And it should be out there for everybody to consume all the time. And as people come in, then it's there for them. It's in a wiki. It's on a blog. It doesn't really matter what the tool is, as long as it's shared in a way that people can read. And I think this is interesting in terms of knowledge retention as well, a term that you and Semple brought up on Tuesday. The idea that people will retire, and they will leave the company, and they will go somewhere else. And unless you've been capturing what's in their heads as you're going along and as they're working, then you have to do a handover exercise. The day you leave, you have to completely download your brain into somebody else. It never really works. So if you can have a culture where people are sharing information as they go, day to day, then that really helps. And I've been seeing this a lot internally. This is my blog. This is my internal behind the firewall blog. Normally, you wouldn't be able to read this. I've taken a very non-controversial screenshot of a very non-controversial post. I will post things internally about things that I wouldn't talk about externally. And I think that's good. I think there's a space for challenging corporations and for employees to be able to talk openly about what they're feeling. Don't get me wrong, I'm not constantly moaning and bickering inside IBM, but it's nice that I have the freedom to talk about positive things and the freedom to talk about where we can change and how we can improve. So, yeah, this is my blog. And, of course, everyone's got a blog. Everyone inside IBM who wants one can blog both internally and externally. And there are some guidelines that people follow, and they just say the obvious things, really. Don't be anonymous. Be yourself. If you're an IBMer, say you're an IBMer. But also say that you don't necessarily represent the views of the company. So this is another internal blog, and this is the Hursley Library. Every time a new book comes in and it's available for rent, for loan, they put up a post with a little picture of the book and a description, and they tag it with appropriate words that describe that book. And therefore, if I'm interested in those subjects, it comes into my radar, and I suddenly know, hey, there's another book that I can, there's another source of information that I can get to. And, that's just one example. There are millions of really great examples I could have picked on, but of course, you're all information professionals, so I thought the example of my local library would be a good one. This is my internal employee directory service. It's called Blue Pages. And this is as it stands today. And you can see it's kind of standard stuff. You can find my email address, you can find my phone number, which I cunningly mosaic out. I don't mind people phoning me, but it's much easier if you don't. I find that I get a lot more done if you don't phone me. You can find my blog. I'm RueReynolds.com. Comment on my blog. That's a much better way to get hold of me, because I check that rapidly. I'm constantly finding people to talk to because they care about me, because they're writing on my blog. People who phone me up, I will deal with them, of course, but they'll normally get my voicemail. So this is the current employee directory service, and this is the new one. This is the one that's in beta at the moment that we're working through. It's called Fringe. Now, as you can see, it's got a lot more information. It's got people connecting to each other and things like RSS feeds being dragged in. And you've seen some examples probably already in this week of kind of internal intranets and how they're evolving and how we're starting to do more things with more data. And this is just another example of that. I think what's interesting about it, particularly interesting about it, is the fact that we can now tag each other. So you probably know of Delicious, the bookmark tagging service, so you can say, this website really interests me, and this is why. You can assign some tags to it. Well, now, if I interest you, and you're another IBMer, you can tag me, and you can find me again. And other people can find me through those same tags. So I've been tagged by 59 people, and these are some of the tags that I've been assigned. So you can see Second Life, Metaverse, Evangelist, Blogger. 8bar is the name of an external blog, and a group of us that and hang around in virtual worlds. And so those are the things that people think about me. Now, I've tagged other people, and I've tagged fewer people than have tagged me. And, oh, by the way, I would never have thought to tag myself with all of these things. If somebody asked me to fill in a skills profile, you know, tell me all the things that you know, there's no way I would have listed, what's an example here? There's no way I would have listed Moleskine, which is the kind of notebook that I carry around with me. I wouldn't have thought to note myself with that particular bit of information, but somebody else thinks it's important. Somebody else thinks that Moleskine is relevant. And if they're looking for everybody who they know who's into those kind of notebooks, then now they've got a way of digging back into it and finding out. May never be relevant again, but hey, who knows, it might be. I've tagged other people, and I've tagged people, interestingly, I've started tagging other people who know about Moleskine, because I kind of got hooked to that idea. MicroBroker and MQTT, both products that I used to work on, and it's really useful for me to know who's still working on them so that I can direct people to them later. Oh, you've got a question for me. Brilliant. Well, I don't work in that team anymore. But here are the people who do, and they've got the most up-to-date information. And I can literally send them a URL that has my list of who I think knows about those things. And other people also contribute to that. And it becomes a social tagging experiment. It's not just what I think of the world. It's what the whole of the company thinks of the world. And so those results become much more interesting once they're aggregated. So other things that are made possible by this, you know, obviously we can do mashups, we can have maps of where people are. So if I dig into a particular community or a particular subject area, then I can find out who's working in those areas. We have this brilliant networking diagram, this kind of social graph of who knows who and what they know about each other. And I mean, if you ever stuck for something to do and you happen to be inside the IBM firewall, that is an amazing application to dig around, because you suddenly have all of these relationships shown in front of you. Oh, he knows her, and she knows about such a subject, and I wonder who else knows about that. And you can just dig around it for hours. Now, it's not a leisure activity in its own right, but it's very useful if you're looking for subject matter experts, or you're looking to find out how to influence somebody. You know, I need to go to a conference, and I need to talk to this person about it. Well, maybe I can't get hold of him today, but who do I know that he knows? And maybe how am I going to bump into him in the right places? So this has been going on for a while. Okay, and we have inside the firewall, we have a whole bunch of social tools. And of course, outside the firewall, I'm at liberty to use all of these and a lot more as well. And this is kind of a snapshot of my desktop on any given day. Increasingly, I've found that I begin to hang out not just in flat 2D social spaces, but also in 3D social spaces. And for me, this began inside Second Life. Since then, it's expanded into other areas. But for me, about March 2006, I signed up to Second Life. And here you can see just two very small examples of me and my colleagues. So this is IBMers hanging out together. In this case, very informally. Here on the left, you can see us. It's called the SOA Hub, the Service Oriented Architecture Hub. So you can go there and you can learn about SOA, which for IBMers is very important, and for our clients and our business partners, this is a very big thing for us at the moment. But it's not just a lecture theatre. It's somewhere that people can go and they can pick up a book, or they can pick up a, you know, they can look at the exhibitions. It's a very kind of self-taught place. And here's just a gang of us hanging out and having a chat. On the other side, something a bit more formal is happening. There you can see our CEO, Sam Parmisano, having a chat with Irving Wadowski-Berger, who was senior vice president of IBM, is now retired, but he still works very closely with IBM. And behind him, there are a whole bunch of us being there with him and being there supporting him as he's giving a talk about innovation this year. In fact, it was November 2006, innovation last year. And he did that inside Second Life. He was talking to 6,000 people in Beijing, physically, in a very large room. And in Second Life, he was talking to probably a slightly smaller audience, but people who wanted to log in and hear what he had to say, and not just do it through the normal web conferencing, video streaming, and having a conference call. They wanted to do something a bit richer, something where they felt they were actually there with him. So you can see there's a whole group of us having great fun, because we're waking up at all sorts of crazy times in order to be there for this this morning in Beijing. And I made new friends and I built existing relationships by that event, that one-off event where I stood on stage with my CEO. It made me feel something, part of something that at the time was just beginning. It was this kind of exploration of Second Life and what we could do with it. Now, I also hang out in other social spaces. This is called EVE Online, which is a space-based, massively multiplayer online role-playing game. It's very big and it's full of spaceships that you can blow up, and it's just really fun. And I've made friends, and I've made new friends, and I've built existing friendships by doing that. If Warcraft is the new golf, then other games are the new golf as well. I talked about how people can get together, and probably you're thinking a couple of things at this stage. You're thinking, is it really worthwhile my time hanging out inside a big 3D thing that looks like a game? That's probably one thing. And the other thing is probably, well, how do you secure it? How do you make sure that people are not sharing confidential information inside something like Second Life, which is obviously a public space? The first one, in terms of why people would do it at all, I was confused as well. The first time I looked into Second Life, I thought, this is never going to catch on. I'm not going to be spending my time doing this. It's clunky, the interface is difficult to control, I'm having trouble just walking around, let alone building relationships and getting to know people. But eventually it happened, and it took probably 10, 20 hours of my time to feel comfortable with the tool. And once I did, I was fine with it. And now it just feels like something else that I do. It just feels like picking up the phone and making a phone call. And you can see there's a range of different meetings going on here. We've got very informal things. We've got a conference. Lotosphere is a big conference that happens every year. And people were coming to that conference inside Second Life as a way of being there when they couldn't physically go to the real one. And we were streaming in the presentation so you could catch up with what you missed. But more importantly, it was a networking opportunity. People who share a common interest in what was going on at that conference were able to hook up with each other and to engage in, and this is where I think that it really comes into its own. Despite the clunkiness and the slowness and just the unpleasantness of using these kind of tools as they stand today, there is something quite powerful about them. And there's something about the sense of presence, about knowing who's there with you, what they're paying attention to, who they're talking to. So that idea of social networking and seeing who is with who and who knows who and who talks to who is actually played out here, not in a graph with labelled arrows, but actually in real time. So here, there's a group of friends standing around together, and if I walk up to that group, I know a couple of things. I know that they know each other and that they're talking about a particular subject because I can hear them, and they'll let me join in their conversation. And I know that if I walk up closer to them, they'll take a step back and they'll let me join in. There are other virtual worlds as well, as I mentioned. One of them is called Quack. It's an interesting world. The avatars, as you can see, are much simpler. They're very abstract, and all you really get from them is where the head is facing. So depending on what of the screen is in focus, that will affect what the angle of the avatar's head. And that's enough. That's enough for me to see what people are interested in, where their attention is being put. The other thing that's interesting here is that there's a shared application. In this case, it's Firefox. It's a web browser. And people are taking it in turns to control that web browser. 5 minutes ago, that same screenshot would have shown a spreadsheet next to it. And 10 minutes later, there would have been a text document being edited, being collaborated on by people around the world. In the same way that you would call people to your office and say, hey, help me fill in this form. You can now do that remotely. This is called Olive, which is a virtual world that's used extensively in training. It's a spin-off from the company that does Bear.com, the second virtual world I mentioned today. And they use this for training people to do a real-world task, where maybe that training them to do that in the real world would be risky or would be dangerous or would be difficult. In this case, it's first responders at a road traffic accident, at a collision. And the people that you can see there are actually logged in using headsets, and they're talking to each other as they would do in the real world. They're using radios, effectively. You know, they take a channel and they talk to their colleagues, and they decide what to do, and they physically have to perform tasks. I say physically, they physically have to click on some buttons in order for some tasks to happen. Things like laying out the cones on the road. So it won't teach you how to pick up a cone and how to take it down and put it down somewhere. but it will teach you what sequence of events has to happen for a road traffic accident to be handled safely. And it's done not using AI and not using scripted characters, but it's done using real people. So the people who are being trained, the people who are practicing to do their job, rehearsing to do their job, the people that they're working with are real people. They're actors. Actors who are playing a particular part, and who are playing the part of a member of the public, or somebody else in the team, or somebody in another team that you also have to liaise with. And of course, if you do this enough times virtually, it sticks with you. You remember that after this sequence of events, you have to turn left and you have to talk to Bob, who normally stands over there, but if he's not there, then maybe Alex will know where he is, and I have to turn left and do that. All of that physical, spatial memory that we're so good at in the real world, I know where the exits are from wherever, whichever angle I'm standing at, because I have a sense of this room as a space. Well, you can get that inside the virtual world as well. This is something we're doing inside IBM. I mentioned our internal blogging system. Well, we also have an internal wiki, and now we have an internal virtual world. In fact, we have internal everything. So we've realized that we can't use things like Second Life and there.com, and these kind of hosted platforms that are run for you and run by other companies and are publicly accessible. We can't use those for everything. And this is the second point of what I mentioned earlier. You're probably thinking it's something about security. Well, one answer to this is just to say to people, you can't use Second Life, you can't use there.com. And you'll end up with a very long list. You'll end up with 20 or 30 things that they can't use. And if you take it far enough, they can't really use email. They certainly can't use Facebook. And that's just crazy. You know, I personally very strongly disagree with the idea of blocking people from being able to access things. They should be able to make choices. And the way it works in IBM is that you make a choice and you're led by the values of the company and the personal business goals that you sign up to every year, and then you make choices around that, and you use your own common sense about what makes sense. But of course, you will sometimes want to have conversations around very confidential material, and you can't do that inside a public space. It would be like using Gmail for your corporate email. It just wouldn't make any sense at all. And therefore, we needed something that was inside our target. So this is Metaverse, which is a project my team is working on. It's a project to build an internal virtual world on our servers, under our control, for the 300,000 IBMers who might want to use it. Last month, we had our 2,000th member sign up. So not huge numbers, fairly small adoption. But bear in mind, that's not had any push at all. That's me talking about it a couple of times on the blogs, and people being interested in signing up on our early adopter program and trying it out. If we started pushing very heavily, we could probably get much larger numbers. But to begin with, we didn't want large numbers. We wanted the explorers. We wanted the early adopters who were prepared to take some risks and try some software that was probably going to be a bit flaky. We built it on top of a game engine called Torque, T-O-R-Q-U-E, by a company called Garage Games. And we've built this thing up. And every week, we add a new feature. That will probably start slowing down. We'll probably start having deliveries of fortnightly or monthly. But up until now, every week, we've had a new iteration. And we put something in. Sometimes it's something quite small. This waterfall over here was added. My colleague Ian, just one day, he thought, well, I think this place needs a bit more movement. It's very still. It's very static. I'm going to put a waterfall in. And I'd already made the mountain with the trees on top. And he decided there was a little gully that would just make it very nice. So he put in some particle effects and some animations. And lo and behold, there was a waterfall. And it got great feedback. That week on the forum, because we have this kind of open discussion forum for people who want to make suggestions or bug reports or, you know, even just new ideas for things that we might want to add in the future. It got some great feedback. A couple of weeks later, I added this. It's a labyrinth. And this asterisk, the your special star, is used all over the place inside IBM. You've probably seen it in some adverts outside IBM as well. And I've made a 3D model of that shape. And I've laid them out in such a way, and you can't really tell, they're laid out in such a way that there's only one path to get from there to there. It's a bit silly, I'd agree, but again, it gets great feedback. And there's a reason that big country houses around the world have got labyrinths outside them. It's a social space. People go there to hang out with each other and to solve the puzzle, but also to talk. And giving somebody a context in which to have a conversation is really important. And so we need to fill this space with as many fun things as possible, and not just be focusing, as we also have been, on how do you give a presentation here. You know, can I upload my PowerPoint to a server and stand in front of a screen with my virtual arm waving around? Well, yes, of course you can. We've done that as well. But I think what's much more important is the social spaces. There's one more I want to point out, which is the rectangle up in the top right there, which you probably can just about make out, which is a football field. And it's got some big boulders, which are physical objects. And if you walk into them, they'll roll. And there's no rules. There are no goals, even. There are no markings on that rectangle other than the rectangle itself. But people play games with it. People will gang up into teams, and they will take one of those boulders, and they'll charge around, you know, trying to get it from one place to another. And, you know, to be honest, you're not going to spend hours doing that. It's not the kind of thing where you're going to be logged in hour after hour playing the football game. And I'm glad, because if that's all everyone was doing, that would be crazy. But what it does do is give you the context of the conversation. Now, Ewan's just stood up, which probably means I've run out of time. Which is great, because I've just finished. And I'm just going to sit down and mention that 8R is a group blog that a few of us write while we're talking about virtual worlds. RuReynolds.com is me. You can find these slides and lots of others on SlideShare/RuReynolds. And thank you very much.
Thank you.